Hoping to avert a dangerous U.S. debt default, President Joe Biden will meet with the top House Republican Monday to negotiate a possible compromise.
All four congressional leaders agree with me that default is not, let me say it again, default is not an option.
Plus, hopes that a ceasefire will take hold as fighting between Sudan's warring sides edges closer to neighboring countries.
Analysts say that intercommunal violence in West Darfur, triggered by Sudan's internal conflict, is likely to spread across the border to Chad.
And SpaceX blasts off to the International Space Station with the first female Saudi astronaut on board. Today is Monday, May 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning. I'm Lori London in Washington. G7 leaders concluded a three-day summit with the denunciation of China's rising military and economic security threats. Still, U.S. President Biden sought to reassure Beijing that conflict with the West is avoidable. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara traveled with President Biden and has this report on the meeting of leaders of the world's richest democracies.
U.S. President Joe Biden sought to reassure Beijing that the group does not seek conflict. At the same time, he issued a warning for China not to invade Taiwan.
There is clear understanding among most of our allies that, in fact, if China were to act unilaterally, there would be a response.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky made a surprise appearance at the summit, invited by G7 host Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida.
By inviting President Zelensky to Japan, we demonstrated the unwavering solidarity of the G7 with Ukraine, and the G7 reaffirmed the importance of the free and open international order based on the rule of law.
Zelensky met G7 and other invited leaders, including Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who has refused to condemn Russia's invasion. Zelensky thanked the G7 for agreeing to provide U.S.-made F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine and for their decision to train Ukrainian pilots to fly them.
I'm very happy. Thank you very much. Thanks our partners. It really will help our society, our people, to save houses, families.
In a sign of warming relations between America's two closest allies in Asia, on the summit sidelines, Biden met with Kishida and President Yoon Suk-yeol, the leader of South Korea. They discussed North Korea's nuclear threat and China's rising assertiveness, two regional threats that have aligned the three countries closer.
I hope South Korea and Japan will have stronger cooperation on issues on the global agenda like economic security.
Biden returned to Washington Sunday to deal with negotiations on raising the U.S. debt ceiling to avoid the country going into default. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Hiroshima.
The president also unveiled a new military aid package for Ukraine worth $375 million during a meeting with President Volodymyr Zelensky, who denied Russia's latest claim that the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut is under Moscow's control. Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamas continues our coverage.
The claim by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has cast doubt on Moscow's insistence that the Ukrainian city had fallen. On Russian state TV, the anchor announced that President Vladimir Putin had congratulated the Wagner private army in helping to liberate Artyomovsk, which is Bakhmut's Soviet-era name. However, Ukrainian military officials also said their soldiers were still engaging Russian forces in fierce battles in and around Bakhmut. The 8-month battle for Bakhmut has been the longest and probably most bloody of the conflict in Ukraine. I'm Karen Chamas.
President Biden and Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy will meet to discuss a debt ceiling compromise Monday after holding what McCarthy described as a productive phone call with the president as he was returning to Washington Sunday. Chris Dignam with Reuters reports.
It's time for Republicans to accept that there is no bipartisan deal to be made solely on their partisan terms.
U.S. President Joe Biden on Sunday called Republicans' latest offers in the debt ceiling negotiations unacceptable, telling reporters at a news conference in Hiroshima, Japan, that he would speak with Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on his way home from the G7 summit about how to cut spending together to reach a deal.
I've done my part. We put forward a proposal to cut spending by more than $1 trillion. And on top of the nearly $3 trillion in deficit reduction that I previously proposed through the combination of spending cuts and new revenues. Now it's time for the other side to move from their extreme positions, because much of what they've already proposed is simply, quite frankly, unacceptable. And so let me be clear. I'm not going to agree to a deal that protects, for example, $30 billion tax break for the oil industry, which made $200 billion last year. They don't need an incentive of another $30 billion, while putting health care of 21 million Americans at risk by going after Medicaid.
Biden also said he believed he had the authority to invoke the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution to raise the debt ceiling without Congress, but said there was little time to test that legal theory.
The question is, could it be done and invoked in time that it would not be appealed and, as a consequence, past the date in question and still the fall of the debt? That's a question that I think is unresolved.
Later on Sunday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen said June 1st was a hard deadline for raising the $31.4 trillion debt ceiling, repeating a warning that the government could run out of cash by that date and be forced to default. Less than 2 weeks remain until June 1st, and concerns about a default are weighing on markets. Republicans are pushing for sharp spending cuts and many domestic programs in exchange for the increase in the government's debt limit, which is needed regularly to cover costs of spending and tax cuts previously approved by lawmakers. After speaking with Biden on his way back home to Washington, McCarthy called the phone call productive and said they will meet again on Monday, and that staff-level negotiations were set to resume later on Sunday.
That was Chris Dignam with Reuters. Sporadic fighting between Sudan's warring factions could be heard, according to residents in the capital, Khartoum, on Sunday, after a Saudi and U.S. brokered deal for a week-long ceasefire raised hopes of a pause in the five-week conflict. Just last week, a VOA reporter heard gunfire, explosions, and witnessed bodies, casualties, and even stray bullets making their way across the border from the town of Tindelti, Sudan, 500 meters from Chad. Observers say concerns are growing that the intense violence in western Darfur could spread to neighboring countries. Henry Wilkins reports from Kufrun in Chad, where police are urging residents to remain calm.
In the town of Kufrun on Chad's border with Sudan, the sound of gunfire is heard coming from the town of Tindelti, about 900 meters to the east. Fighting had broken out overnight there between ethnic Arab armed groups and what witnesses said were black Sudanese civilians attempting to defend themselves from what they referred to as Janjaweed. Injured men began coming across the border to seek refuge and medical attention. A man with a bullet wound in his left shoulder said there had been clashes over the border and some armed men have entered the town. A vehicle arrives to take the injured man to the nearest medical centre. Analysts say that intercommunal violence in West Darfur, triggered by Sudan's internal conflict, which started on April 15th, is likely to spread across the border to Chad. Bakary El-Medni, a public administration professor at Long Island University in the United States, is a specialist on conflict resolution in Sudan.
It's not in the interest of Europe or the United States or anyone for Sudan to continue to be in conflict, because it's 100% positive that the continuation and prolonging conflict in Sudan will spill over.
Back in Kufrun, chaos sets in among the thousands of Sudanese refugees who fled into Chad. The bodies of friends and relatives begin to arrive across the border. The refugees pulled the shirts over the faces of the deceased, makeshift shrouds. VOA counted at least three bodies. For some, the scenes were too much. Analysts point out that the Darfur War of 2003 quickly spread to this area of Chad. Hoinathi Ramaji is a Chad-based analyst with the Institute for Security Studies.
It's something that's very dangerous and that can very easily spread the fightings to Chad, because the composition of the forces and presence itself, it's very ethnic.
Chadian security forces begin to clear the area of crowds as more bodies come in. Later in the day, the Chadian chief of police, Hamid Daouda, gave this comment to VOA on the events that took place in Kafrun.
If it happened that the rebel Sudanese shot the gun or not under the Sudan government, I've said that all the measure has been taken. All are in control now. So if you have seen it happen, it will not happen next again. From where they saw it coming, measure has been taken to master it. Thank you. Keep cool, you know, and walk. Keep cool.
500 meters inside Chad, one bullet hit the ground nearby and another zipped past. Some members of the crowd began to panic and retreat. This reporter left the area. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Kafrun, Chad.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Greece's prime minister, whose conservative party scored a landslide election Sunday but without the seats in parliament to win outright, indicated he'll seek a second election in a bid to consolidate victory without the need of a coalition partner. 1 week after deadly cyclone Moka made landfall in Myanmar, Rohingya survivors are desperate for help. Residents at a camp for internally displaced persons told VOA the storm made hundreds of Rohingya refugees disappear. The Category 4 cyclone destroyed bridges, power lines, and huts in refugee camps and towns in Rakhine State, home to over 600,000 Rohingya Muslims. Saudi Arabia's first astronauts in decades are headed to the International Space Station on a chartered multi-million-dollar flight. SpaceX launched the first Saudi female astronaut as well on Sunday, along with a Royal Saudi Air Force fighter pilot. They're joined by an American from Tennessee and a retired NASA astronaut. This is VOA News. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Over the past 5 months, there has been an increase in Chinese migrants making the long journey from South America to the U.S.-Mexico border, much of it by foot. Reporters from VOA's Mandarin service asked some of them why they left China in this story, narrated by Elizabeth Lee.
Latino migrants crossing the Rio Grande dividing Mexico from the U.S. is a common sight. But what is less common is Chinese migrants making the same dangerous attempt. This woman says it took her a month to get here. The number of Chinese migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border has increased sharply. According to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, nearly 10,000 crossed on foot from October to April, compared with just over 2,000 who crossed in fiscal year 2022. This man goes by only his surname, Jin, for fear of retaliation against his family in China. Back home, he worked construction and struggled financially.
It's really hard to survive in China.
He traveled for 42 days through South America to the U.S.
This trip is really tough. Everyone's feet got lots of blisters, emotionally and physically. It's all very, very tiring.
Many Chinese migrants take similar routes, flying from China to Turkey and then to Ecuador because of its relatively loose visa policy. From there, they travel by foot and bus through South and Central America to the U.S.-Mexico border, some paying a guide or asking for directions along the way. The Chinese embassy wrote to VOA saying the Chinese government has always opposed illegal immigration and adopted various measures to stop illegal exits. This video, shot by VOA Mandarin, went viral on Chinese social media, prompting the former editor-in-chief of China's state-run Global Times to respond on Chinese social media Weibo. He wrote, "China is progressing rapidly, and now the vast majority of Chinese people don't need to take the risk of swimming across the border river." Catholic Charities of the Rio Grande Valley says about a month ago, some 100 Chinese migrants a day were arriving here at this Texas shelter. This man from Shanghai made the journey with his wife and daughter. He's using a pseudonym, fearing retaliation from the Chinese government.
All Chinese people know our Chinese government is too powerful and too controlling.
Some of these migrants say they heard about the South American route through postings on Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, where those who have made the journey describe what to bring, where to meet a bus, and where to find bathrooms and food. This man, who chooses to use only the name Wang because his parents are still in China, explains why he left his homeland.
I don't have any hope for the future of China. I feel like it's going to get worse, going back to the time of the Cultural Revolution.
Professionally, what I did in China is not valid in the US. I'll need to find low-level jobs. Work that Americans don't want to do, we'll go do. I'm already mentally prepared.
Many of these migrants say they plan on moving on to New York or California, where many Chinese live, to face the challenge of surviving in a new land. For Hailun, Mo Yu, Ning Lu, and Victor Hugo Castillo, Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Scientists say the flood that recently sent rivers of mud tearing through towns in Italy's northeast are another drenching dose of climate change's weather extremes happening all around the globe. Lucy Fielder with Reuters reports the United Nations Weather Agency is now warning the likelihood that Earth briefly hits a key warming threshold is growing closer.
For the first time ever, global temperatures are now more likely than not to breach 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit within the next 5 years. That's according to the World Meteorological Organization. But that did not necessarily mean crossing the long-term warming threshold of 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial levels set out in the 2015 Paris Agreement. Petteri Talas is the WMO's Secretary General.
There's a 66% chance that we would exceed 1.5 degrees during the coming 5 years. And there's 33% probability that we would see the whole coming 5 years exceeding that threshold 1.5 degrees, which is, of course, not very likely to happen.
One thing that boosts the chance of hitting 1.5 degrees is an El Niño weather pattern expected in the coming months, when warmer waters in the tropical Pacific will heat the atmosphere above and push up global temperatures.
It's a conclusion that that we haven't been able to limit the warming so far, and we are still moving in the wrong direction.
The warning came as another international team of scientists said record-breaking heat waves that hit large parts of South and Southeast Asia in April were made 30 times more likely by human-induced climate change. The region saw Bangladesh at its hottest in 50 years, and Thailand and Laos also hit by temperatures that caused widespread infrastructure damage, power shortages, and a spike in heat stroke. The scientists for the World Weather Attribution Group said humid heat waves that used to happen once a century in Bangladesh and India now tend to occur every 5 years, while the heat in Thailand and Laos would have been virtually impossible without climate change.
Lucy Fielder reporting from Reuters. In Rabat, Morocco, a group of young film enthusiasts have created an association that aims to get more young people interested in cinema and audiovisual production. Emmanuel Mojadibai has this story from Casablanca, Morocco, narrated by Salem Solomon.
3 years ago in Morocco, a young Guinean wanted to share his passion for cinema and its ability to change the world. So he founded the artistic association Univers Ciné Plus, or the UCP.
We are promoting art and culture, as well as African diversity, the richness found here in Africa. We can create jobs thanks to the cinema. So if we mobilize young people and teach them the craft of filmmaking, those who may find themselves without work will be able to train themselves and be self-sufficient.
Transmit the message.
Since Kamara started the group, it has grown to 94 members from a variety of African countries. The UCP offers a number of classes. The most recent is a master class on audiovisual and cinematographic production and distribution.
Here at UCP, before starting a production, whether cinematographic or television or radio, you have to start with training. Because the students are young, they are passionate, but they are not necessarily professional. the UCP also produces video and audio clips and programs such as Letterbox, hosted by Silver Jinganoji, the communications officer.
It's a show that aims to promote young talent, to highlight the talent which is hidden because these young people are talented but don't have many opportunities. So Letterboxd goes to these people to find out a bit about what they do and show it to everyone.
Ebade Production, a larger company whose work includes commercials, news reports, and sporting events, supports the UCP's efforts to find and develop talent.
These young people, if we trust them, and if we offer them a good framework where the necessary conditions are met, they will be able to do very interesting things that can contribute to human development.
One of UCP's major projects is A Magic Voice, a film that will highlight how Africa's diverse cultures are passed on through the oral tradition. For Emmanuel Mouajidimbay in Casablanca, Morocco, Salem Solomon, VOA News.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe recently released a report looking into allegations of the forcible deportation of Ukrainian children by Russian authorities. There have been a lot of horrible crimes committed by Russia's forces in Ukraine, but the separation of children from their families is among the most vile and repugnant, said Ambassador Michael Carpenter, U.S. Permanent Representative to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe.
I think it goes without saying that no government should ever be committing crimes against children. And to do so with the aim of erasing their national identity so as to pave the way for one state to take over the territory of another is simply unconscionable.
There has been a broader effort by Russia to engage in forcible transfers of the Ukrainian population since 2014, and that over 1,000 children have been taken from Crimea in a process that began even before the full-scale invasion of February 24, 2022, explained Ambassador Carpenter.
The report notes these children have been sent as far away as Siberia and the Russian Far East. And while thousands of children have been taken from Ukraine, as of April 23rd of this year, only 361 have been returned to Ukraine. That leaves thousands of families still torn apart by Russia's authorities and thousands of children traumatized.
There are several ways that these children are taken from their families and caregivers, said Ambassador Carpenter.
One way is that they're forcibly separated from their parents or guardians by Russian authorities during the so-called filtration process. When parents are detained and get sent to the filtration camps, the children often get sent to different detention centers. Another way in which Russia has, to be blunt, stolen Ukrainian children from their families is by offering all expenses paid trips to children's camps in places like occupied Crimea, as well as in Russia and Belarus.
For children that are adopted, this process often entails actually changing the child's name and even their place of birth, which then makes it impossible to ascertain their true identities once they disappear into the Russian Federation. The U.S. is helping Ukraine to return these deported children to their homes and remains committed to holding Russian authorities accountable for these rights violations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.